This week on the show, does the iPad pass the family test? Who will be the platform provider of the future? And Roku gears up for a sale. All this on This Week in Media, episode 169. Hey there, boys and girls. We are back for another edition of This Week in Media, in which we attempt to tackle all the intrepid topics in the media business. I'm your host, Daisy Whitney. I am back this week. Last week, I believe you heard from Alex and Tim and other folks, and they took care of the show in my absence. This is Twim169, and Alex is in the Seychelles. So, Alex, we hope you're having a lovely time and that it is warm and beautiful and you're taking all sorts of fantastic beach shots or whatever it is that you are doing there. But we have a terrific lineup nevertheless. If you are watching or listening or in the chat room live on the This Week in Technology Network, thank you very much for listening and watching live. I will try to jump into the chat room from time to time to see if you have any questions that you want me to ask the guests. For those who will be listening on their iPods, whatever, streaming it during the week, thank you for tuning in. As always, we have Tim Street. Tim, hello, how are you?
Hey, Daisy, doing well. It's good to see you sitting still and not running around crazy like you were at NatPe.
I know, that's how Tim and I have, not surprisingly, run into each other at most of the recent shows, like NatPe, where we were at last week. And yeah, it was pretty much dashing back and forth. Although, I have to give us a little bit of credit. It was mostly due to Tim's expertise and none of mine. But we were roped into the Celebrity Chef Kitchen at NatPe, where we had to make margaritas on the fly, along with Corey Cronengold, I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, from Twisted. We were the online video team, and I don't drink margaritas. I don't know anything about mixing them, so I was just basically totally guessing, like, yeah, pour that and use that ingredient. But it was Tim with his little polishing, finishing touch when he suggested instead of a salt rim, we had a sugar rim, and because of that, the online video new media team won the margarita mixing competition at NatPe. So thank you, Tim.
You're welcome. Hey, that was fun. I had no idea what I was doing. I just made it up.
We had a good time. We have fun together. Sort of like this show. We just kind of make it up as we go along. Also, Brian Stelter. I had the pleasure of seeing Brian at NatPe last week, which reminded me that I need to have Brian more regularly on this show because he always is a fantastic contributor because he's on top of everything new media related. Thank you, Brian, for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to see you again, although this time just via video.
What exciting stories do you have very briefly in this week's paper? What was the most recent thing that you just covered to get us up to speed?
Well, coming out of NatPe, the conference that you and I and Tim were all at, I wrote about Nancy Grace getting a court show. Not very exciting, but it was really the only big-time syndication news at that conference. And then today I wrote about YouTube and how President Obama was doing a live interview with YouTube. It aired on Monday afternoon, and it was basically using questions from YouTube users that bubbled up to the top, and then Obama answered some of them today. So that was a kind of fascinating use of new media by the White House today. So that's the most recent story.
Very cool indeed, our new media presidency. And we also, back by popular demand, whenever we have Zach Louie on, I always get lots of emails and tweets and requests to bring you back on. So you have a very vocal fan club, Zach. What are you up to these days? You're doing your tea show still, is that correct?
Yes.
And how is that going?
Incredibly. Episode 56 just posted today, so wow, that's a lot of episodes. So I'm hearing some raucous applause. Thank you. 56 episodes is a lot. You know, in near 170 right now, you know how it is.
Well, it's just showing up is half of the game sometimes, or 90% of the
that's
game,
true,
as they say. So thank you so much for being on today. So
thanks for having me.
We're going to talk, obviously, you know, we're going to talk about the iPad. Can't not talk about it. You know, biggest technology story of the year, even though the year is only a month old, but really, I sort of mean the last year. But we had even bigger, I don't want to say bigger news, but we had sort of more recent news over the weekend, I think is important to address first. A lot of this is coming out of out of Apple entering the ebook market, and that was a big kerfluffle. Gotta love those words, right? You can drop in a word like kerfluffle. Big kerfluffle over the weekend between Amazon and Macmillan, which is one of the big six publishing houses that includes titles from St. Martin's Press and others. And essentially what happened was They didn't agree over ebook pricing. And Amazon has been pricing most of its books on the Kindle, most of its bestsellers, at $9.99. A lot of publishers in recent weeks have said, you know, that they want to be able to price them a little bit higher, so that we're basically not saying to the marketplace that $9.99 is the value of the book. Obviously, they're trying to protect some of their brick and mortar investment as well. And this has all become so as a result, Macmillan pulled his books. I'm sorry. Amazon, I apologize. Amazon pulled the Macmillan books from its site over the weekend. And all of these things transpired. And sort of the end result was, on Sunday, Amazon issued a letter saying that we're going to capitulate to Macmillan's position. I'm not sure if all of the Macmillan titles are back yet on Amazon's site yet, but I'm friends with a number of St. Martin's authors who were quite distressed over the weekend. As you can imagine, you have a book coming out or a book that's out right now and you can't buy it on the biggest online site for books. Drove a lot of traffic to Barnes & Noble sites and places like that. There are a lot of interesting questions that this raises. I'm going to start with Brian Stelter. Power dynamics, especially in the media business, do you have a sense, do you even know yet, of who has them? Is there more power with the publishers right now? Is there more power with Amazon? Is there more power with Apple? Because a lot of this is happening because when Apple announced the iPad and the iBooks functionality, it went with an agency model for book pricing, which means publishers are going to be able to price their books around $12.99 to $14.99 for bestsellers, new releases, and then there'll be the typical 70-30 split. That's different from how Amazon has done it. Amazon has had lower prices, although it's been a loss leader. It's kind of a complicated pricing structure, but nevertheless, who has the power, Brian?
I think the best thing that can happen to the publishers is to have someone like Apple come in and create competition. I would like to say the media companies have power because it's, after all, their content. And what we're doing, what Apple and Amazon do, is just basically create dumb devices for the media companies then to power with great content. But look, the publishers need someone like Apple to come in this case to shake up the market, to create competition. In this case, it worked out quite well, I think, both for Apple and for the publishers, to have some new energy and some new options in the marketplace, even though we're a couple months away from the iPad actually being out.
Tim, what I think is interesting is when you sort of look at who are the big players in the media business these days, who have the sort of power to influence big decisions like this. I mean, you are looking at folks like Apple and Amazon and even Google, because there's talk about Google having sort of a Google Books platform or Google Book Edition. So talk about that a little bit, and sort of that's kind of an interesting shift, isn't it, from how media has been conducted. But we're basically talking about companies that aren't necessarily traditional content providers that seem to have the power.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, they don't own the content. I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 85% of all media in the U.S. is owned by six companies. And those are the big companies like News Corp and Disney and Viacom. And it's got to be killing them that Apple and Amazon are having an effect, and so is Netflix. And we've talked about Redbox before, how this affects the way they're selling their media, and they don't like it at all. Now, it used to be that there was a rule in place called the FinCEN rule, but I think sometime during the Clinton administration, that rule that talked about how, or I guess it was, it prevented you from owning content and distributing that content on vehicles that you also owned. And so once that was out of the way, the FinCEN rule, then these conglomerates were able to buy up local TV stations, which they did, and now they can distribute their stuff there. This whole Amazon thing and the iPad reader and you know, the other ones that are out there, that's changing the print world as well. And there's no rules in place, and there's going to be a lot of jockeying going on. So I think this isn't the only time we're going to see people arguing over prices. I think people want to get the best prices locked in so that they're comfortable with that. You know, the funny thing is, though, you don't hear people arguing that much over audiobooks. And audiobooks seem to sell a lot higher than these e-readers do. I just bought a new book through iTunes using an Audible. I guess Audible goes through iTunes, and I picked up Seth Godin's new book, Linchpin, and it was about $22.
How are audiobooks priced, Tim? I mean, isn't there a wider range with audiobooks or are there kind of standard prices like you'll find for ebooks on the Kindle? Although I guess there's a variety across all places, right? I mean, there must be for audiobooks too.
Yeah, it's a little bit different than the rest of the iTunes store. There, the prices range quite a bit on the audiobooks, and nobody seems to be, you know, fighting that. At least I haven't heard anything bubble up. I mean, it could be. I haven't gone looking for it.
Zach, I have a question for you. Do you think other publishers will follow suit? Do you have a sense of, I mean, what will become the main price for books? For it seemed, I know you're a Kindle user as well. Is that correct?
Yes.
So you're used to, like myself, paying $9.99 in most cases for a bestseller, a new release, you know, depending on what genre that can compare anywhere. I mean, I, as most folks know, I read a lot of young adult literature. Most hardcovers for YA are priced at $17.99. But most, Sarah Palin's book is probably, you know, $25, $27. Her Fearful Symmetry, those type of big hardcovers are in the $25 to $27 range. It seems as if, I mean, it doesn't seem as if. I mean, publishers, a lot of the big publishing houses have said even before the iPad came out that they wanted to price books higher in the ebook format. So is this just the beginning? And what do you think that consumers should be expecting over time, Zach, to pay for ebooks?
I am a little bit bothered by it. I look at it this way. A $27 book, a $15 book, a $20 book, they're all priced that way. Partly because of the content, partly because of if it's a hardcover, the kind of art on the jacket, the manufacturing, the shipping, etc. So much of that is factored into why a book is priced that way. Now we have the Kindle, which we have this content that's already been written and is already going to be manufactured either way. They're digitally delivering it to us. So essentially, the only money that they're paying is the original cash that they were putting into producing the books. So I feel like, yes, it may be taking away some of the money from the book sales, but all these companies are hopping on to, you know, like you guys said earlier, it's scary that Amazon and Netflix have such a big pull in this traditional media market versus all the larger companies having it before. Is they're chasing the money. You know, we have this age bracket that is consuming all of this media in a different way, and we're trying to capitalize on that because we are eating up our media like crazy. We're spending the most money. It's where the cash is. So where the cash is obviously where they want to go. So places like Apple are making they started it with the iPod, and they're making your audio device a place where you can buy audio and listen to audio. And of course, the iTunes store has catapulted since then. And Kindle did it with the books, and now Apple's hopping into the book game. So it creates a lot of competition there. So we have competitively priced things. Yes, yes, yes. But as far as the pricing on the books is concerned, I see why they're trying to raise it, because it can be done. People will pay $15 for a book. I will pay $15 for a book on my Kindle if I really want it, because the convenience of having it delivered and having it all in one device is really super nice. But I feel like we're going backwards. I feel like the Kindle set a standard almost in a way. And I was a little bit bothered by the iBook selling point at $15 for new titles. I shrugged it off because, hey, you can read PDFs on it anyway. I'm not condoning anything, but what I'm saying is, whatever, I shrugged it off. And from your perspective, being an author, I can see where the price shifting may have a different effect on you than it does normal consumers. But you being a reader as well, I think we can all sort of understand the dynamic where that pricing model could be changed. Should it be changed? Why is it being changed? Is it being changed just for the hell of it, just so we can make extra profit? Or is there an actual reason? The manufacturing and the production has nothing to do with it. This is simply, can we pull more money for our content that we're already delivering in the same way anyway? So it bothers me a little bit that this is happening, but it's sort of inevitable. And if the places that are producing this content, and if Amazon and if Apple can't create a model to keep up with file sharing and with the new scope of media, then if they fail, it's their own fault. So this is sort of like their own way to say, hey, can we raise the prices a little bit? Which I think is backwards, but
I think a number of people... Go ahead, Brian.
I was going to say, ebooks were never going to be $10. That was a foolish price set almost as a starting point. You can't set a hardcover book at $28 for, as Sarah Palin's is, and $10 for an ebook. It just never would have felt sustainable.
Oh, I completely agree. It's definitely a huge price gap. But it's been established. We've had the Kindle One's been in production for 2 years now, something like that. And I've had my Kindle Two for about a year, and that's just what we are being given now.
I think it is going to be frustrating for the early adopter ebook customers, that's for sure. I mean, I think a lot of folks bought a Kindle thinking, well, I consume enough books, it is convenient, and over time you can amortize the cost of it because you're figuring you're buying enough books where actually you're saving money. So there is that point, but then let's remember, it still is, you know, it still is reaching a relatively small number of people. We're really still at the beginning of this. But I think that read an interesting piece by Scott Westerfield, who's an author, really analyzing it. And what he talked about is that, you know, there's a lot of discussion about, you know, the cost of the production of ebooks has got to be so small because it's electronic. Well, yes, it costs a lot less to produce the actual version, electronic digital version, for an ebook edition of a book than to print it. But you have to back up and think about everything else that went into the cost of producing a book that has nothing to do with the actual file, whether the file is a digital file or whether we'll call it, you know, a file in terms of the actual physical book. You have to back it up into you know, the cost of the editors who worked on the book, you know, the marketing, the promotion, obviously, you know, all the way back at the beginning, just the time that the author takes to put into it. So I think, you know, when you get down to the end of the supply chain and you see, okay, and you're sitting there weighing, well, an ebook is, you know, really costs nothing to deliver. True, but there are many things that obviously have to be accounted for. But I guess the thing I want to get at, though, is I wonder if with these pricing battles, do we think, Tim, that the book business is learning from the mistakes that have been made in the music business? We hold the music business up as an example of, you know, a business that went kicking and screaming and resisted a lot of changes. I don't know. I can't quite tell. I want to get your take on that. Do you think that book publishers are being smarter, more agile, and more aware of consumers' desires than the music industry was when that business was being roiled by change?
I don't know. I mean, only time will tell to see. But, you know, they say that any industry dies before the new industry that's killing it replaces it. And that seems to always happen. So I don't know if there's a good answer for the book industry. I hope that the iPad and the Kindle will, you know, will grow into tools that we'd like to consume this media on, and that it will help artists monetize what they're creating, but it's changing.
Tim, you've been obviously a great voice on this show and just in general for the independent producer, kind of, you know, being very aware of their needs and their business model. When it comes to the book and the publishing side of the iPad, do you see this opening up a lot of new opportunities for self-publishing, for smaller independent presses, in the way that, you know, obviously we're only doing this show because of, you know, changes in digital delivery, because of iTunes, because now, you know, the cost to produce a web show and a podcast is much cheaper. Are we going to see that happen as well? Will there be much more opportunities and where it could be a platform for new authors?
You know, if you take a look at it, there are so many things that you can do with it, with the iPad, that you can't do right now on the internet. And I think it's going to open up a whole new way of telling stories, both for the traditional book industry and for the filmmaking industry, as well as the video game industry. And there, just like the early days of TV, when they took radio shows and put them on TV and you had people standing in front of mics doing their radio show, that's what we've been doing with internet video for the last couple of years. We've been taking TV shows or things that are similar to TV shows and putting them on the internet. We haven't developed these new interactive formats because there hasn't been a good way to monetize it. Everything's been free. And now with the iPad and the iPhone, this kind of puts the genie back in the bottle, to where an independent can sign up as an iPhone developer. You can learn how to author an iPhone application or an iPad application, and you can create new interactive stories, and I don't mean choose your own ending type stories, but things that allow the consumer to explore the story in different formats that we haven't even thought of yet. That opportunity is now there.
Brian, what was your reaction when you saw the unveiling of the iPad, in terms of its capabilities generally, but also specifically as somebody who is working in the print business?
I was thrilled for about 10 minutes, and then I realized it has so many limitations that I can't imagine buying a first-generation one, and I don't know anybody who would buy a first-generation one other than Apple enthusiasts. I really wanted to love it. I've been asking for 2 years just to have a simple little tablet I can curl up in bed with and watch Hulu on. Obviously, they're not going to let me watch Hulu, though, because they're not going to allow Flash on that platform. Is that a short-term problem? It might be. And in the long-term, might not be a problem at all. In the long-term, HTML5 might solve all of these things. But for the time being, this thing is a giant iPhone. And I think we're going to have to I can't imagine it has the same penetration rate as the iPhone. I think it's going to take a lot longer for this thing to catch on. I think I came away from the iPad last week thinking it might help the print business. As you said, we're talking about newspapers and magazines that would love to see new business models for consumption. And the New York Times was on stage last week showing off a very cool app using the iPad. I think I came away, though, thinking we're going to need 100 of these devices or 50 of these devices at least. Each of these is like a 2% solution to the broader problem. And so I like the way that David Carr put it today in the Times in a column. He said, we can see the future from here. We're not there yet, but at least from the iPad, we can see the future of consumption. But in my mind, it's only a 2% solution for now. I can't see it being a dramatic overnight game changer the way I think we kind of might have dreamed before it was announced.
Well, it's curious. I wonder why. I mean, it's, you know, it's hard.
Why did we dream of it being a solution?
Well, no, it's hard for something to live up to the type of hype that this device had beforehand. But obviously, we've seen Apple deliver some truly revolutionary products. And I think a lot of people were underwhelmed. They felt that this wasn't revolutionary enough. And I guess just why? Why didn't they go further with it?
I think because they couldn't. This is one of my guesses as a consumer who wants something different than what they provided. I don't want a third device. I want a better second device. At CES, there was a laptop that had a detachable monitor, and then that monitor was a tablet. Now, that's perfect. I can't imagine a better experience than that as long as I can reattach the monitor without too much trouble. By adding a keyboard and having a dock and all these things, Apple almost kind of walked up to the border of it being a laptop, but they wouldn't go all the way, and because I guess they have to protect that second device, that Apple Mac market share. So to me, they couldn't, because they had to make it a third device to not cannibalize their sales, I think that's partly why it left people feeling underwhelmed.
Zach, what was your reaction? And do you think sort of the absence of these features that we've been talking about, do you think they matter to, you know, beyond our world? I mean, we've said it before, we live in the bubble here on the show, and that's kind of what we do. We're bubble enthusiasts. But outside of the bubble, do the problems that we have and that we cite with something like the iPad and with other tablets, do they matter to sort of regular consumers, i.e., is there enough that's attractive about something like this to build a strong market?
I love the fact that we're not regular consumers. Let's all have a good giggle over that. I'll tell you what, I've been pretty excited for it for a number of reasons. Firstly, I am in the market to upgrade my laptop because it's a few years old. I want to get a newer one, right? New and shiny product. We all know how that is. I have a machine for the office that I will edit video on and do all my video production, all of my work. And when I'm not there, essentially all I need is a really sexy device with great battery life that I can do all the office, like Word applications, things I need to be doing, i.e. I work for the iPad. All of these things that I could just list off essentially can be done with the iPhone. And with me, I have a dismal battery life on the iPhone, so I don't put much stock into it, and I don't care much about using it because then my phone will die, and we all need a phone. So then I got myself wondering, how about this iPad? So essentially, I thought I was on board from the beginning. The extra $30 a month for the 3G is whatever. The storage space is whatever. I like the fact that it's SSD. That's cool. The no flash, I don't really care about because I essentially just need to be able to get productivity done versus being able to have this big entertainment piece. There's data there to put your things on there. There's iTunes. There's plenty of room to entertain yourself in other ways. That being said, I do need a laptop when I'm shooting on location. If I'm doing client work that needs, you know, I have to convert all this footage from my 7D into all these ProRes files, and they want to see a preview here, I have to edit up a rough copy and things like that, and that cannot be done with the iPad. So for someone like me as a professional, I need a laptop. I need a work computer. But I really think that the iPad is a step forward. For me, I'm going to take this from Tony Hawk. It's a Kindle with rims. I love my Kindle. I love my Kindle. I use my Kindle at the gym. I use it while traveling. I absolutely adore my Kindle. But the iPad is a sexier Kindle. Great battery life. I don't use my Kindle more than 10 hours at a time. That's just me. I don't know about you guys, but it has great battery life. It's an extremely sexy display. And what we're looking at is the first generation of a great product. Are we looking at something that's going to change the face of the world? Is it the best way to experience web browsing? I think that those are all overzealous statements that happen when you're releasing a product. So I'm going to let that slide.
So you see it as an entertainment device for you, that your hardcore work will be done on your laptop, but that you would use this device more for entertaining.
Well, I look at it this way. I wake up in the morning and I make a cup of tea. It'd be really nice to have a device that's cooler than my iPhone, like bigger than my iPhone. That's just not big enough. A device that's not my laptop that I have to pull out and it's weighty. I like the fact that it's clickable. I feel like I'm a target market for something like that. Just something very casual and browsy. Do I think of it as solely entertainment? Definitely not. I would love to have it for something more, but I think that at the moment right now, until we see more apps being developed, that's going to be the main focus of it for now. What we're looking at is Apple giving us a shell of we're getting a promise. We're the traditional Apple model. We're getting just the blank iPhone, 2G, no apps, you know, core apps, not that much crazy stuff happening, except obviously we have the App Store now, so it's a little different. But we're getting a blank product that is going to be refreshed over the years, and they're going to make all the money they want to off of, because all the Apple enthusiasts and all the people with a little bit of extra chowder to throw around, $499, are going to essentially buy this device. They're going to initially buy this. And from there, we're going to have the updates. Those same people will get the upgrade. And the people that weren't early adopters on, they're going to say, oh, you know, I like what they've added here. This front-facing camera for iChat Theater is really nice. They're going to pick that up. We're just looking at a slippery slope of upgrades that will eventually evolve into what they actually want. Because we definitely don't have the version of the iPhone that Apple wants us to have. But we're waiting for them to give it to us. So the same point here, we're just taking baby steps toward the ultimate goal, I think.
We may be doing that for a small group of people, but if we're going to talk about, if we're talking about the media element of this, talking about finding new ways for average consumers to consume media, I can't imagine, at least with this device, being bought by my family, being bought by my brothers or my mother. It doesn't pass that test, but the iPhone did, I think. The iPhone passes the family test, because it replaces your phone, replaces your camera, replaces your BlackBerry. The iPad hasn't replaced anything yet. Maybe in a few years it will, but for now it doesn't pass that consumer mainstream test.
Well, we're still looking at, I mean, first off, the product isn't even released. We're looking at the wake of an iPhone release that's been out since 2007. Yeah. I mean, it's 2010 right now. There's plenty of time for things to develop, but I completely agree with you. It's a middle device that is not necessarily a must-have right now, but I think that for the production cost that it's costing them and for the price point, they have a definite target market, just like they did with the iPhone, that can evolve.
I think it has time to prove itself. Makes sense.
I see some opportunities here for the business traveler. I mean, somebody like me, I go to a conference, I've got to carry around a laptop. It gets heavy after carrying around 8-10 hours a day. And to have something that has a battery life of 10 hours that I can sit in a conference in the audience and do emails, that's extremely attractive to me. Sure, I can do it on my iPhone, but it's not that convenient. So it'll depend on how well you can type on the iPad is a big thing.
How high you can prop your knees up in a
Come on now.
The other thing is, you know, how can you interact with television while you lay in bed watching television? That's a big thing. And then school. Back to school. If I was a college student and I could get all my textbooks on this device, I'm in. It's the right tool for school. as long as there's no heavy lifting in terms of programming or editing or you know, all the stuff that you need more power for. And then the last place that I see some opportunity for it is grandma. Somebody who likes to read, sends out a couple emails, goes to a few websites, doesn't need huge computing power, but likes the idea of reading a newspaper, reading a magazine, and being able to send email. I think those are some great categories where there's opportunity for it.
Tim, will we have an iMag store on it, or do you think that magazines will develop apps for it?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I feel like the magazine world is, there's no rack space for them on the iPhone. There's no rack space for the iPad as of yet. Will it be part of iBook, like a Barnes & Noble has a magazine rack, or will it be its own thing? I don't know. But it does seem like it does need that shelf space. It needs to be put in a box. And then I also think that we will see interactive stories eventually break out and games break out of the apps. And kind of, you know, the app store itself will divide up the way that a department store divides up.
And one
look
of our,
at it this way.
Let me get to you in one sec, Zach. One of our chat room folks had made a good point that earlier in the conversation, when we're talking about books especially, that what we might see is, you know, rather than authors releasing books in the iBook store, they may just make apps for their books. Of course, we've seen apps in the past for books. But because it's such it's a better reading platform, there might even be more opportunities there. Of course, there is still the whole issue. There's 140,000 apps already, and you have to fight through the clutter, and you have to get seen. Zach, you were going to say something. So go ahead.
Think of it this way. Let me get back to Skype here. Think of it this way. When I think of the iPad and I think of the iMag store, I think of reading GQ or reading InStyle on this gorgeous 9-inch display. And think of it as far as the market for advertising on this device. Say you buy you get your subscription for the year. Let's say it's the same price to have it delivered on your iPad. So instead of having the actual magazine, you have a gorgeous developed for the iPad magazine, where when you have ads or when there's things mentioned in the articles or when celebrity guests are writing and you have freelance journalists or whatever, all these names, all the byline, this ad, this thumbnail, this picture, all these here are clickable, expandable. They can take you back to the source. You can buy from there. And they're all getting CPC links from that company. So GQ is going to be getting that. You know, it opens the world as far as for magazines. I'm really glad you brought that up, because it opens the world from a magazine perspective, because there's so much interaction that can be done with a glossy, pretty magazine that you sort of don't think about when you're holding it in your hand. But when you're holding it in your hand on an iPad, it's totally different. And I liked what Tim said before, being in a conference room with the iPad. It's much more discreet than pulling out your laptop with the fans. And it looks like you're not texting on your phone, so it's much less rude. I feel like someone in the chat room I was just reading said something very great. It's not supposed to replace anything. It's a new thing. It's not a better cell phone like the iPhone was. Right. They're creating a market for a target market. That being said, and I'll be the first one to admit this, and it's probably something I shouldn't say, but I just bought a new car, and I'm really looking into mounting one of these in my car as a nice touchscreen stereo with portable navigation. I have navigation, but how slick would that be? Having you're all thinking to yourself right now. Let's say auxiliary to auxiliary, just a nice visual GUI application for your iPhone for your iPod in your car. That's gorgeous. Everyone
wants
that.
You know what I'm thinking, Zach, is I don't want to be driving near you. That's what I'm thinking.
Listen, it's much easier to use than your car stereo or the next button, because it's big and it's right there. I could argue for hours on that. But honestly, I think that this new market, especially the magazine idea, I love that, is something that's interesting and new. And I'm, for one, am not the smartest, genius, most crazy, intelligent person in the world. So I'm not going to sit here and try to tell reasons why it was a bad move, because Apple has a lot of cash right now. So they're doing some things right. So I'm not going to assume that I know better.
Can I just say one thing that I think that we definitely need as we move towards this ebook and iBook world more is we're going to need better covers for Kindles and for iPads to read them on planes. Because let me tell you, all the flight attendants are getting hip to these electronic devices. It used to be when I had, you know, when I first had my Kindle last February, March, you know, I could read it during takeoff and all of that. And you know, if they tell you to turn it off, you just say, well, it is off. The wireless isn't on. But they all know now. They tell you to shut it down. And of course, look. Sorry if y'all think I'm a scofflaw, but I don't think that, you know, I mean, something that has the battery power of a digital watch, I'm pretty sure isn't going to cause any harm on a plane. So I think what we actually need now, if somebody out there wants to make it, I will happily test it out and bring it on the show, is a cover that looks just like a paperback book. That's what
nice
we need.
Work.
We need just like something. So that's
right.
What I, sometimes I bring a paperback now too, and I slip the Kindle inside the paperback. And I'm like, oh, I'm just reading this paperback.
Let's go halves on it, Daisy. We'll do 50 equity points each way. I'll design it, and you can sew it.
Because I'm a girl, I know how to sew. I have a one final...
I just assumed. Sorry. Your love of young adult novels just makes me think that you quilt every night.
You know, that's, you know, when I'm not busy here on TWIM, I'm quilting. Tim, I have one more iPad question for you, and then we're going to get to a couple other stories because there are other things going on in the media world. Are we moving to a post-Flash world?
You know, that's a great question. I want to look at Hulu. You can watch YouTube on the iPhone. That's not a problem. So, and with the HTML5, it looks like we are headed that way. The big resistance, though, is going to be from the advertising world because that's how ads are delivered. And so we'll have to see how they can switch over. There are some companies like one of my sponsors, MDialog, that they're using the adaptive QuickTime streaming so that they can serve ads inside the iPhone and inside the iPad as well. There's going to be a little war here, and if you're going to have a device that won't serve HTML5, then I don't think people are going to buy that device.
Roku. Company we talk about a lot here on this show. We kind of romanced them a couple weeks ago. It was remember that episode, Tim, we had Clayton on, and it was you, Clayton Morris, Alex, and myself, and we were all just raving about Roku. Well, you know, we're admitted Roku fanboys and girls. The company said recently that it wants to raise $30 million this year and setting its sights on a potential IPO in 2011. This was something that the CEO, Anthony Wood, told to Bloomberg. Basically plans to raise about $30 million in private funding this year, may go public next year. Brian, from where you sit, I mean, because you obviously have a terrific sense of, you know, what's happening in new media, but you can kind of represent the mainstream a little bit. Do you see this device having true mainstream potential? And with this kind of funding and these kind of plans, is that going to catapult it to more of a mainstream alternative device? Mainstream alternative, I don't know. Maybe that's an oxymoron. Anyway, go ahead and answer it.
I'm a little bit of a skeptic, and you guys hopefully will prove me wrong on this. To me, these devices feel like a bridge between TV and the internet. And to me, it feels that bridge is being built pretty quickly by other providers, by the TV set manufacturers, and by the cable providers. At Verizon Fios, for instance, I can already watch a bunch of internet video content when I'm at home in Maryland on my Fios-enabled set-top box. So to me, these feel like a bridge that we may not need for much longer, but I'm willing to be convinced otherwise.
Tim? Roku?
Yeah, I agree with Brian. I think the play for them is to get bought out by one of the set-top or one of the TV manufacturers and have it powered by Roku. You know, much like TiVo. I mean, there's a lot of people that love TiVo. I still love TiVo. I have several TiVos. But, you know, their deal with DirecTV went down the tubes, and DirecTV makes their own thing. Comcast makes their own thing. Time Warner makes their own DVR. So it's really about getting into it or about having content that people really want. And so it does seem like they're aggregating content to their channels and making that happen. But there needs to be enough value there that they can get a stronghold in the marketplace. And other than that, it does unfortunately seem like it's just a gap fill.
You know, it's
interesting. I was hoping you would say that.
Go ahead, Brian.
I was hoping you would say that because I didn't want to quite go on that ledge and say they're getting ready to be bought out, but it would make sense to me in that way.
Yeah, and maybe this is part of that positioning, right, Brian? That you know, saying we're going to raise $30 million in funding, we're getting ready for an IPO. I'm not trying to suggest there are nefarious motives or anything like that, but perhaps that is, you know, this is a company that has done well, that has a great halo effect around it as a terrific user interface, user experience, and all of that. You know, maybe this is all part of getting ready to sell.
I think one of the most interesting thing to me in the last few months in the cable space has been the rush by companies like Comcast to get in this space and to be connecting the internet to TV. I think they had a rather sudden realization they were going to have to play in this space, and that's happened, you know, in the past few months.
Speaking of Roku, I talked with Jim Lauterbach at NAPI last week. He is the CEO of Revision 3, and he said that when Revision 3 shows launched on the Roku right around Thanksgiving, he actually saw a 10% increase in views. Those are overall views for Revision 3 shows. Interesting that was, you know, specifically that week that it launched on the Roku, so that it could drive that kind of traffic increase. But along the lines of TV Everywhere and alternative devices, Brightcove last week said that it's working with cable programmers on TV Everywhere pilot projects that would allow viewers to access content from those networks, from the cable networks, via the web as part of their traditional cable TV subscriptions. Brightcove wouldn't name the networks that might be using it or what type of programming they would have access to. But Brightcove is a huge market leader in the online video platform business. Some of its customers include Discovery, A&E, Fox, TBS. This is the light reading story that I'm quoting from right here. Wow, does Brightcove become a competitor to Comcast? Is Brightcove, by doing this, how does Brightcove actually compete with a TV Everywhere Xfinity offering? Zach, what are your thoughts on something like this?
I, for one, welcome it. I think, first off, let me just say that I love the thought of digesting all of my media on whichever device I can get to first. I don't necessarily want to be sitting in front of my TV. So rather than buying a TV episode, or rather than BitTorrenting an episode, or finding a hacked stream somewhere, I like the idea that there is an actual place that you can go with a great connection, that you can get that content that you want that's just ported basically from the TV signal, I'm guessing, is what we're looking at. Sort of like taking it, let's use Discovery Channel, for example. Basically taking Discovery Channel's feed and putting it on a website, essentially, right? Brightcove is taking the platform to the web.
Yep.
So I love that. I think that's great, because I sometimes find myself when I don't – because I don't have cable. I've a long time gotten rid of it. And are you still without cable? I need to know this.
I am still cable-free, just like you.
Rocking the Apple TV?
You know, I find I probably watch a little less TV than I did when I had cable. Okay. Yeah, I actually mostly use the Apple TV for workout videos on YouTube and renting some movies. And then we watch all of our TV shows on Hulu. 30 Rock, The Office, and Glee. Watch it all on Hulu.
Good. So essentially what we're seeing here is a trend. We're seeing places like Hulu. We're seeing places like Boxy get a lot of the chatter happening because people want to watch things when they want. They don't want to have to go buy a TV schedule. So we're getting sort of a backlash against TV among our market. Now, keep in mind, all the things I'm saying is isolated to because we're not regular consumers, as Daisy puts it.
We're bubbleists.
Exactly. So what we're seeing is a backlash against traditional television, which was sort of fought early on. I know that I myself went and picked up an antenna for my HD TV just so I could watch Conan's final episode at the time I was supposed to watch it, not on Hulu later. That being said, I went out and got that antenna. I paid extra money, and I've been flipping it on and checking out some TV before I go to bed versus firing up my Xbox and turning on Netflix, because sometimes you just want some things on for noise. All of that sort of encompasses down to my point to where if there's an easy way to get it and I don't have to deal with, you know, the restrictions of, like, the same way with getting DRM from iTunes, people would much rather go to Amazon and get a DRM-free song. It's sort of the same principle there. If there's no restriction and I can digest it how I want it, when I want it, I'm going to be more inclined to do it. So if Brightcove signs these deals, I would be much more inclined to pay, you know, a few dollars or whatever, if it's free, if it's ad-based, however it's based, to have it put to where I want to see it. I'm probably going to download less shows or watch a little less Hulu and just try. I could try to make a show at 7 p.m. if I can watch it on my laptop. You know, I'm not necessarily sitting at home then. But if I'm out at a coffee shop or whatever, like, it's... it adds another reason. So it's sort of like we went backwards and then we stopped it. We hated it altogether. But I can see that if this is happening, I'd be much more inclined to watch cable, if that's what you kind of want to call it, on the web. So sort of the same mindset with people using the Sling Player, except essentially you don't have to have it going on your own TV at home. So it works, I think.
You know, I was at a coffee shop during the Christmas holidays in the East Bay, and a guy actually brought his iMac there. The big 27. Can you believe it?
Oh, hell yeah. Hell yeah.
My husband and I couldn't believe it. We're like, dude, really? Yes. Like, why couldn't you? Whatever is on that, you couldn't watch at home. He actually brought that and was just sitting back in the coffee shop watching a DVD or something on the iMac. So
I love that.
Hey, whatever works, right? Whatever works. So, you know, maybe he was just sick of the small screen. Tim, we're going to need to wrap up in a few minutes, but something that came up at Nappy that I think ties into this Bright Cove question that I want to ask you is, you know, there were a number of folks from kind of internet video startups, platform startups at Nappy. Some of them said to me, you know, we're the companies, the Kalturas, the Brightcoves, the platforms, Ooyala, that are going to be the sort of the platform providers of the future. And, you know, a lot of these are companies that, at least for Brightcove, have been around since at least 2004, a significant player, hugely significant company, but still relatively new in the scheme of things. And I think back to, it wasn't aware of it, thinking about it at the time, but, you know, back to 1980 or whatever, when cable was just starting to take off, and Comcast was a small company, and Cablevision was a small company. It was before this became huge media concerns. And I wonder if, you know, looking ahead in 5 or 10 years, will Brightcove, will Kaltura, will these sort of tech picks and shovels, heavy lifter type of companies become the platform providers of the future in some way, Tim?
Well, I mean, if you look at history and you go back to the gold rush with the picks and shovels, and you look at who is still around from those days, you've got Levi Strauss and you've got Wells Fargo Bank. and Levi Strauss allowed the miners to go look for the gold, and Wells Fargo allowed them to convert the gold dust into cash and allowed them to save that cash. So the companies that are going to provide the future and are going to be around are the ones who are going to do that type of thing in this space. You know, who is going to let us creators go dig for gold? Who's going to provide us those opportunities? And then who's going to allow us to turn our content into cash and to make money off of that cash that we make? And so those will be the platforms that will survive.
Brian, Zach, do you guys have a sense, any companies that you've seen recently that you really like that you think we'll still be talking about in an even more significant way in 5 years?
Go ahead, Brian.
I lean toward the content companies here. There's no new ones that come to mind to me, but I think some of the first movers in the web video space are the ones that the rise to the top, because having a first mover advantage is massively important and impossible to understate when it comes to these kind of new territories. I think the difference between the idea of the Cablevisions and the Comcast and the Cox cable providers years ago and what we're seeing now is that those companies are still providing the access to the home. And I think as a result, they're able to choke a lot of this content a lot more than we have seen so far. Whether they will actually do that or not remains to be seen. But I came away from NAPI, I came away from the syndication show, of course, having been reiterated the message that content is king. So I suppose I look at some of the video startups that are slowly but surely gathering steam and gathering more views as being particularly important.
And, you know, Zach, question for you. One of the other themes at NAPI that I've talked about a little bit in my New Media Minute last week and just in my coverage from NAPI was the international focus. There's a lot of growth to some degree is tapped out in the U.S. You know, cable multi-channel penetration is pretty much what it's going to be, but there are a lot of opportunities for shows overseas. You, as an independent producer, have you talked to people at all about taking your tea show around the world? Is this something that, I mean, do you see, I guess it is international already because it's on the web, but I'm talking about sort of more pure play international deals with a mobile provider or a cable company or a satellite company. I don't know if you're at that level yet, but is that something that you think about or entertain?
Well, the great thing with me is my show is created for, let me phrase it really. The great thing with my situation is my show is made for a select group that already has a built-in community that is worldwide. We do have a lot of viewers from Europe that I get regular emails from, and they're great. As far as on a completely international basis for Adagio TV, I'm not looking into any kind of expansion there, because we're focused on things like we're opening a new retail store in April. You know, like we've got different things to worry about. As far as my other projects, like as myself being a director, you know, I'm focused on grabbing the best kind of work that I can find and, you know, and putting it out there, making it digestible in whatever format I can with whoever I can. As far as something like Bottles, Blends, and Brews goes, you know, we're writing a totally new season for that show. And rather than writing it for the web, we're writing it in a different model. We're writing it sort of more television-based. I feel like the big money for content creators and for people that are creating web applications in this media space at this moment right now, like Brian said, I feel like they're slowly getting there. We're slowly making things. My Bottles, Blends, and Brews show wasn't at the point where I can make big money off of it at all. So it's being developed into something different. We're slowly getting there. I think right now the big money is going to be in a company like Boxy or in things like Hulu, things like that, where we are putting the content that's already been made. Content is king. The content that is already king needs to be fed in a great way, in an easy way for our on-demand culture and our on-demand generation. So for right now in our on-demand landscape, the big money at this point, in my opinion, are the people that can give those things that they want to them at the precise moment. Now, is it coming the time for us to create ourselves pick and mortar, you know, making our own Comcast? You know, is Revision 3 going to be the next huge TV network in the internet, things like that? I feel like right now at this perfect time, we're not cultivating that exact path, but some people, i.e. Revision 3, et cetera, are well on their way to doing that. But as far as within the next few years, which I feel like bigger things are going to be happening with on-demand culture, it's going to be with people that can give us the content, not necessarily create it and give it to us, because it's a whole lot more money that goes into making great content than there is to putting better content out there. So for me, writing my new show, you know, to be picked up and bought by a place like Next New or like a place like Food Network, things like that. So I feel like that is the curtainscape.
And we're going to wrap things up on that note, but just I wanted to mention very briefly sort of a fun story that one of our regular TWIM contributors, Jason Perrier, pointed out this week from PC World, and that is that the Pope is encouraging all priests to enter the digital age, and apparently there's going to be an event on the 44th World Day of Communications, and it's going to be the priests and pastoral ministry in a digital world, new media at the service of the world. I bring that up just to demonstrate the reach of social media. Here it is. Hey, the Vatican's going to be talking about it. So,
like I said,
there you go.
Zach, that are going to be ahead are the people that are going to be giving us the content when we want it. The Pope wants in.
Exactly.
Zach,
where can people find you online?
You can find me. Just go to my Twitter.com/ZachLouis. I have a weird last name. It's spelled odd. It's said odd. Don't judge me. Twitter.com/ZACK. LUYE for the audio listeners out there. And you can find all my links from there because I tweet and I muse.
Never would we judge you for having an oddly spelled last name. Brian Stelter, where can people find you?
Also slightly odd, twitter.com/Brian Stelter.
And Tim?
I'm working on a new podcast for small business owners. It's called smbiz.com.
Excellent.
SMBIZZ.com. Please check it out if you want to be a guest on the podcast.
Oh, that's fantastic. How exciting. We'll have to talk about that more next week. We will be back next week. This mess you've been listening to is This Week in Media. Oh, you can find me at DaisyWhitney.com. We are over and out.